Hi, I'm Aisha, and I'm a former host of Mocha Single Mothers by Choice, or SMCs. Like you, as an SMC, I decided to become a mother knowing I'd be the sole care provider and parent of my children, at least at the outset. The Mocha stood for Black, so I'm using the word Black, and I'll be discussing being a single mother by choice from a Black woman's lens. You'll connect with all the interesting and fun things about this non-traditional path, like discussing which sperm to use and some hard truths about fertility and the realities of dating as a single mother who doesn't have a co-parent to rely on occasionally,
and what it's actually like to parent as an SMC.
This is the Black Single Mothers by Choice podcast. In this episode, we are picking up with part two of our discussion of adoption as SMCs. Returning our guest hosts, Angela and Michelle, if you recall from part one, Angela is an SMC via adoption, domestic infant adoption, to a five-year-old son. And Angela will be speaking from a firsthand experience as adopting as a single mother by choice and is also considering welcoming a second child. And then Michelle is also an SMC by adoption, and she'll be speaking from her firsthand legal perspective about adoption and drawing from her vast experience as an adoption attorney in Chicago. Again, we have the disclaimer that adoption laws can vary state to state, and you want to make sure that if this is your path, that you consult an attorney in the state that you are currently residing in. Okay, so we're going to dive right in. So during episode one, we covered some of the basics of adopting as a Black SMC. And in this episode, we're going to go a little bit deeper into the details. The world would have us believe that Black people don't adopt. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to talk about the different steps in the process, the home study, and other things that we should consider when we are setting up our lives, if we believe that adoption is our path to motherhood. And then, so we're gonna go ahead and dive right in. I think where we left off with our last episode is that we were talking about the three different paths to adoption. We talked about adoption, domestic infant adoption. We talked about foster care adoption. And in this episode, we wanna start and pick up with international adoption and go from there. And Michelle, can you give us a overview of international adoption? And then Angela, if you can jump in with what you know from your research and from your own experience, let's go ahead, take it away.
Okay, so international adoption is basically the third option with regards, or the third path that you can take for adoption. It's important to note that international adoption is on a steep decline. Within the last two decades, it's reduced to the United States by 75%. So it's one of those things that you see countries closing on a regular basis, and I actually don't really see that stopping, to be honest. There are a lot of countries that are still open, but it's not the pathway that it used to be even 5 years ago, to tell you the truth. One of the things that people can do to figure out where they want to go is you can actually Google the U.S. State Department and adoption, and it will pull up all the countries, and each you can fill in the country. So put in Haiti. It will tell you all the requirements that are required in order to adopt from Haiti, for example. Or if it's a country that's closed, like Ethiopia, everybody heard about Ethiopia. Ethiopia is now closed. If you put that country in, the State Department will tell you it's closed. It will give you what ages you have to be, what relationship, if any, you have to the child. It will tell you who you can work with. It gives you that basic information to figure out, is this a country I realistically want to go to? There are some exceptions if you're actually adopting like a niece or a nephew. But generally now, most countries are Hague and or follow the Hague rules. So even if you're relatives, you're going to have to jump through those hoops, which require agencies, and it's far more expensive. And so it's one of those things to take into consideration. The other thing is that the Hague was actually ratified by the United States. And when it was ratified, it shifted how agencies worked. It was a very costly process. So a lot of agencies actually closed. But one of the things that the Hague did, because their stated purpose was to try and stop child trafficking, one of the things that they did is that they tried to make sure that kids stayed in country if that option was there. So the other thing that you've seen a radical change in international adoption is kids are not coming as young as they used to. I've been doing this for a long time, and I remember when people were adopting internationally and kids were literally 3 months, 4 months old. Now it's rare to see kids that are two is about the youngest you're going to see. So international is a great option if you want a little bit older child and you don't want to do foster care. Clients usually come to me on the back end, but I do know that people are particularly interested in international adoption. Traditionally, the reasons they were interested is because they felt that they didn't want to return a child, right? So when you adopt internationally, that adoption is done, you come home, there's no give back that you might have to risk in foster care, that you might work with the birth mom and then she changes her mind, or work with an expectant mom and she changes her mind. The thing is that countries close. So what people are beginning to realize is you work with the country and then a country closed. I had one woman call me. She was on her fifth country because she had started country, and each country closed before she. There are those types of things. The other thing is that technology has changed tremendously. And the other reason that a lot of people want an international adoption is so that they'd never really have to deal with birth family. And the problem with that is that we now have DNA technology and internet and social media. And even in the poorest of countries, people have smartphones because they don't have computers and people are connecting. Plus, there's open adoption now and international adoption. The other thing that happened with the technology is we discovered that there was tons of fraud in international adoption. And that's one of the reasons so many countries closed, because Lala, for example, they discovered that people were bringing babies to be adopted that weren't theirs. So towards the end of Guatemalan adoptions, they started doing DNA testing from the mother to the child. So you get a lot of fraud. That's part of the reason Ethiopia closed. They're now talking China has a lot of fraud, despite what we thought was the one child policy, that there really was a lot more to it. So international adoption is not used as much as it used to be.
Yeah, I did. And I certainly agree with everything Michelle has stated. So just speaking from my personal research and experience, and then a lot of the things that I've read, a couple of points I wanted to make. One, following up on what Michelle said about countries closing, part of why the countries are closing specifically to America is because there is some growing negative American sentiment, I think, for certain countries. And the reason why, quite frankly, is a few bad apples. There were some situations where, not necessarily MOCA related, but where American families adopted children and then internationally and then didn't do the right thing. One of the most famous stories is a woman, I think the child was from like Russia or Ukraine, and the child had some special needs. And he was probably about 8 years old, and she decided she didn't want him anymore. And she literally pinned a note to his chest and put him on a plane and to fly him back to his home country. Wow. And when those stories happen, it really doesn't look good for Americans in terms of our ability to do the right thing. So that's one point I wanted to make. It's awful. The second thing that was personally my challenge and why I opted against international adoption, it seemed like a lot of the countries, when I was looking at their requirements, they were definitely much more weighted towards couples than singles. I'm not saying it's impossible to adopt as a single. Certainly many people do it, but I just saw that as additional red tape to an already complex process. And so that was one of the reasons for me. Additionally, time and money. It's the last point that I'll make. International adoptions can be considerably more expensive because on top of everything else that we talked about before in the US, that average 20 to upwards of 50K, now you've got to add on travel expenses. And you usually have to travel to that country multiple times. And then what I also found out in the process is that not only are you traveling to meet the child and meet the adoption agency there, meet with attorneys, et cetera, but often some of the countries will require you to stay in that country for a certain amount of time, which could be a month, 2 months. And so it makes sense why they might require a couple, particularly if you have other children. It may not be possible for you to pick up and your life and not work and be someplace for 2 or 3 months. So for all those reasons, I think it's particularly challenging for an SMC to adopt internationally.
One of the things I'm seeing is that more countries actually have longer time frames. It used to be you could zip in and zip out. And in fact, there were countries that would deliver the babies to you. There was a point where Korea would just put the babies on the plane with a transporter and you would get your baby in the country. Now, some of these countries require you to actually live there. And a lot of people can't drop and roll for 6 months and live in another country.
Thank you. So I have two questions, one for Angela and then one for Michelle. So Angela, when you talked about the mom who put the note on the baby to send the baby back, this kind of comes up. I've seen it in SMC spaces, and we've seen it when there's discussion about using a donor of a different race. It sounds like it's borderline cultural competencies. Are you competent? Are you well-versed? Do you know enough about the culture that you could potentially be adopting from in order to adequately do a good job of raising a child? Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Yeah, transracial adoption. Geez, we could do a whole segment just on that alone. And certainly it's a challenge here domestically and not always with international adoption, because obviously you could be Black and adopt someone from the African continent or whatever. But yeah, I think that it just adds, and Michelle may know more than I do, but my brief opinion is that it adds a whole other wrinkle to transracial adoptions. Transracial adoption is certainly a challenge. I think that certainly some people do it beautifully, but other people just aren't cut out for it. It really comes down to, is the adopting family willing to do the work to understand how to properly care for that child, how to celebrate that child's culture, how to protect that child from things that they wouldn't from a child with their own race, like microaggressions, like racism, et cetera. I think when you talk about international transracial adoption, I think it's just one additional layer on top of everything we've been talking about, the challenges of international adoption. So I think that it's certainly possible, but I think that the family really has to be willing to dig in and do the work to cross those cultural, sometimes language, and obviously also distance boundaries. So it's possible, and some of those relationships are great, but you got to be willing to do the work.
So what I'd like to say about open and closed is that many people have different ideas of how to define those. Today, I tell people there's no such thing as a closed adoption. Closed would be technically where there's no information from the birth parents to the adoptive parents. But the reality is with DNA technology, the internet, anything is only temporarily closed. Things can open at any moment. And I think that adoptive parents have to enter adoption with the concept that it could open at any moment. Open is the other end of the spectrum, which has to do with the relationship between the adoptive parents and the birth parents, or the adoptive family and the birth family. The reality is you can talk to 100 different people and they will define open 100 different ways. For some people, open means that you've exchanged information. So you know who the other family is, you know where to find them. For other people, open means that you're all going to be at the child's birthday party together. So there's a real range of what open means. It may mean letters and pictures or sharing a Facebook group. It may mean that you get together every couple of months. It really ranges. Absolutely. And there's a lot of research now that is suggesting that it's in the best interest of the child to have this information. I think it could also be helpful for the adoptive parent, especially when it comes to health and medical information for the child. Ultimately, if it's not a safety issue, it can be a good thing. There are obviously parameters that need to be set. The other thing is that about half the states now have what's called post-adoption contracts that are enforceable. It's really shifting that this contact can be actually legally enforced post-adoption.
Angela, what has your experience been like on the perspective of open, closed adoptions? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm actually a very strong advocate of fully open adoptions. And a couple of caveats I would add. One is that it's always, regardless of what the hopeful adoptive parent or parents are interested in, it's really at the behest of the expectant mother and then birth mother, right? So you could say, hey, I'm open to having you come over for weekend barbecues and hanging out all the time, but it's really up to her comfort level. And frequently, the then birth mother's comfort level will change. She may think that she wants this amount of contact, but then it can evolve and change after birth or even years after that. The adoptive parent really needs to be respectful of that. And I also wanted to double click on what Michelle said about what's best for the child. 100%. There's all kinds of research that says that adoption is trauma. And it, even if my son was adopted by when he was a few hours old, it's still a traumatic experience to be raised by someone that you were not born to. So because of that, inherent within the whole open adoption is, when do you tell your child that he or she is adopted, mm-hmm. excuse me. And best practices are, and research shows that the earlier the better. And the way that I was taught by my particular agency is that it should just become part of that child's persona. So if you asked my son, who are you? He would say, oh, this is my name and I'm 5 years old and I have a dog and I live in this state and I'm adopted and I like to play soccer. And like, it would mm-hmm. just be part of the things that he would rattle off. So he is very clear that and knows from a very young age that we are an adoptive family. And I think that is what's best for his growth and development, to never have it be a surprise.
Yeah. In SMC spaces, it's tell them early, tell them often. Right. Mm-hmm. So even yep. as you start with them being weeks old, months old, they are not really going to understand what you're saying. But as the parent, we are getting our footing on how we want to approach this. The more we practice it, the more muscle has memory, right? The more natural it sounds to us. And that gives yep. us an opportunity to deal with our stuff before we have to fully engage in a meaningful way in conversations with our little people.
Also, if you start early, before the kid even understands, you get to practice as an adoptive parent. So if you're mm-hmm. telling your child their story when you're changing their diaper, I remember when I got you from the hospital and this is what you were wearing and this is how yep. I met your birth mother. By the time your child gets to be three and starts asking harder questions, you've already practiced for 3 years and you're comfortable in your presentation. And yeah. it comes much faster than people realize. People always mm-hmm. seem shocked when their 8-year-old comes home and says, who's my real mom? And they're like, how do I deal with this? I'm like, they somehow think that kids aren't going to ask until they're 16 or 18. And that's just right. not the case.
Oh, yeah, they ask early. My kid was like yeah. two. I yeah, was like, we're having this already.
Although I had always told my child his story, I think it was three. And as single moms mm-hmm. by choice, another thing I find fascinating, regardless of how you become a single mom by choice, is all the single moms by choice who are shocked when they get the question, who's my daddy? Where's my daddy? And they think that question's going to come at 16. And I'm like, no, that's no. three.
Mm-hmm. No, they talk about it on the playgrounds in preschool. Like my daughter mm-hmm. My daughter shared her story, I think, when she was probably 3.5, 4. Little kids talk about this because they see who comes to pick you up. Yep. They see who yes. drops you off. And they're
then figure they it
have, out. Yeah, they figure yeah. it out. Michelle, I do have a question. I know I have heard of kinship adoption, and then like on the telling of our stories, is there, explain to us a little bit about kinship adoption, and then from your experience, how do we tell that story as adoptive parents in the kinship adoption scenario?
Okay, so kinship adoption basically means that you're somehow biologically related to this child. You're the grandparents, the aunt, the uncle, so on and so forth. And in reality, most adoptions, if you actually look at the stats, are kinship adoptions. But kinship adoptions can be done either inside or outside of foster care. So in a lot of circumstances, kinship adoptions are actually foster care adoptions, because when the child is taken from a biological parent, they are placed with family, and eventually that comes to adoption. But there are also a lot of situations where a mom will just leave the child with her mother or have her sister raise her child while she went to jail or whatever the case may be, and an adoption occurs between family members. So that's really the basic of that's the basic definition of kinship adoption, but it can happen many different ways. Actually, it also happens internationally. You do get mm-hmm. people who are here who they go adopt their niece from Nigeria, for example. So that mm-hmm. would also be a kinship adoption, but it's an international adoption. The story is a little bit different because with kinship adoption, they're obviously going to see this family for the most part. They'll see them at family reunions or the family barbecue. So how different families deal with it varies. In the past, a lot of people kept it a secret, but just like any other adoption today, you can't keep these secrets. So right. The best thing to do is from day one, the same story. Like I remember when I brought you home and you know that Auntie Jo is also your birth mom right. and tell the story so there's no surprises later with how family came together.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Can we talk a little bit about the process of adoption? I know I got stuck at the home study step and I got overwhelmed and I got bewildered. I looked at my living situation and I realized I had a 2-bedroom apartment and I could not take a male child if I had to go pick one up in an emergency situation. So could you speak to a little bit about that, Michelle? What is the process in general?
Sure. So first of all, I want to point out that the process for foster care adoption and the process for domestic infant adoption and international adoption, they all have slightly different rules, and all 50 states have slightly different rules. And from a practical standpoint, depending how many kids are in foster care, some of those rules are sometimes side-eyed. So if they really need foster parents, the rules sometimes go out the door. I love that
sometimes.
But in general, you're going to need a space for the child. In my state, you don't actually need to have a separate bedroom for the child, but you do need to have a certain amount of space for the child. And it depends upon the age of the child. Depending what you're looking for and where you're doing it, you may actually have to have a separate bedroom. And kids of separate sexes or opposite sexes need to have separate bedrooms. But I think it's like, depending upon the state, some states it's like age 3, other states it's age 6, other states it's even higher. New York City, for example, is going to be a lot more lenient and kids of different sexes sharing a room than Texas, because New York City kids of the opposite sex share rooms all the time because they live in much tighter, smaller spaces. So the home study is going to require in most states some adoption education that can range from a minor amount of education to 30, 40 hours of education. Usually when you're doing foster care, it will also include how to raise the substance exposed child, how to raise the physically abused child, and some of those other special needs, which, by the way, may be present in both domestic infant adoption and international adoption, but you may not cover that area. I find that domestic infant adoption does a better job in their education on how to talk to your child about adoption than foster care adoption education. They will also come out to investigate your home. So you're going to talk to a social worker, and the social worker is going to make sure you have the space, that you have the requirements of the home. For example, you're going to need smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors, and they want to make sure that your home is safe. They are not going to, as my friend says, they're not going to run a white glove over your refrigerator to make sure that you don't have dust. That is not their concern. Their concern, people always want to go out and have these spotless homes.
Because I have dust.
Right.
I have dust.
I have a friend who was a social worker in foster care, and she said every time she came into an apartment that was spotless and had all white furniture, it made her nervous, because she's like, how are they ever going to take a child who, as we all know, children spill everywhere, and you can just see the Kool-Aid or the ketchup getting on the white couch and the parent losing it. So it's not a cleanliness test, but obviously they don't want roaches and rats and all the mice running around your house. That's going to be a deterrent, right?
Yeah. So depending upon which path to adoption you choose, you may have a lot of guidance on this topic. Basically refer to it as your risk profile of what you're willing to accept and what you're comfortable with in terms of potential challenges with the child. The agency I worked with had a whole training session on this and stuff we had to read and so forth. And so I make an analogy to, if you've ever gone to a financial planner and they say, hey, what is your risk profile, how aggressively do you want to invest and so forth. And you have to make a bunch of decisions to come up with what your strategy is. It's similar. And what I mean by that, before you go live as part of this home study and approval process, if you're working with an agency, they're going to ask you questions about the birth mother risk behavior. So things like smoking during pregnancy, things like drugs, things like how much prenatal care did she get, if any, because sometimes they don't. Things like her family, for her and the birth father, well, at this point, expected father, their family history. Do they have any family history of disease, of mental illness, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that you, as a prospective parent, would have to think about, and you have to make some decisions about. And this question comes up a lot. It's one of the first questions people ask when I talk to people who are thinking about adoption. And one of the things I always share is that you need to try to be as open to this as you can, because the more prescriptive or the more conservative you are, this goes back to an earlier topic we talked about in the first session, is the more it's likely to increase your wait time. And there are things that you can do to help mitigate this risk. Obviously, you can do research if you are matched with the expectant mother on what she shares medical history is. A lot of people will actually go, and I did this myself, and talk to a pediatrician. Some people don't know that most pediatricians will give you a free appointment if you are adopting or if you are pregnant, as an almost interview to see whether or not you would want to use that pediatrician for your child. So I went in and met with my pediatrician who had been recommended to me, because there were some health concerns this is why I was trying to decide to match with my son's birth mother. And I said, hey, she's dealing with this and this. What do you think about this? Should I be worried about this? What's the likelihood of this being passed down to this still unborn child? And that helped me to feel confident about moving forward. And the last point that I'll make about this is gender. A lot of folks will say, oh, I already have a girl, so I want a boy, or vice versa, or have a preference on gender. And it's just one of the other things that folks should be aware of. Again, the more specific you are, potentially the longer that you're going to wait. For me, it is, because I know more, I've experienced more, I've talked to I had multiple failed matches before I was successfully adopted. So I talked to a lot of birth mothers, and you just know more. So when you're going into for the first time, it's a natural tendency to be more conservative, because it's just things that you don't know, you haven't been exposed to. But now I know multiple friends who adopted children who had drugs in their system, because of course they're tested when they're born, right? I know one situation where the birth mother was actually, depending upon the laws in that state, was arrested because the child had drugs in his system when he was born. But for me, I've seen that it's all kind of a continuum. And I know that child personally, and he's fine. He doesn't have any long-lasting effects from having been born with drugs in his system. So I'm much more open now than I would have been 6 years ago starting this process.
I have to say, with drugs in your system, that's a really broad term. And people say substance exposed, or they refer to drugs. And the problem is that you really need to do your research on it, because not all drugs affect kids the same way. And so when people say, I won't take a drug exposed kid, I'm like, what do you mean? Do you mean a kid that's exposed to marijuana, ecstasy, cocaine, heroin, methadone? Which drug are we talking about? And is this something that she's doing every day, or is this something that she does once in a while? And alcohol is the drug that's known to be the worst, which they can't really test for. So there's a lot of risk with adoption. When you are not carrying the child, you don't know exactly what happened in the past. That's one of the advantages of actually adopting from foster care or international and adopting an older child, because by that point, a lot of times you have a lot more information. Has this actually, the drug exposure, is it actually causing learning disabilities? Is it causing ADD, ADHD, RAD, ODD, all the numerous things? You have a lot more background information, where when you're adopting a newborn, there's only so much information you have at that point. On the other hand, a newborn hasn't been exposed to bad things outside of the womb. And these are also risk factors that you have to decide as an individual family what works better for you.
Yeah, I will say there was a point in my pregnancy where pretty much at the last second, where there was a concern that my child would be born with a disability or some sort, the microcephaly, that I would, and I had to make a decision in the moment that all kids deserve love. And God gave me this kid. I'm gonna love the hell out of this kid. And that was just that decision. And I think that all kids deserve love. And I want to ask, because when I was considering adoption through foster care, and to wrap us up, what are some tips and advice that you can give? Because I didn't anticipate having a 3-year journey to my second, but I did know ahead of time that adoption was absolutely on the table for me. So I wonder if there were things that I could have done earlier in the process to prepare my life, my living situation, to accept a child into my home. What are some bits of advice that you would give to any SMC who's considering the path to motherhood and knowing that adoption is a path for them, not knowing that it is on the table for them? Absolutely.
I would say build your village. And this is not from my personal experience, that taking a child into your home is going to radically change your life. It's going to change your time schedule, your sleep schedule, your eating schedule. Everything resolves around the kid. We think of us being the bigger people, and so therefore we are the ones in control, but frankly, they're in control because we've been to their schedules. So because of that, as a single mom by choice and not having another person to drop and roll, you have to put your village in place. Whether that's family or friends, you have to have your village in place.
So I definitely agree with that. And I think we had talked about the village last time, so I'm glad that Michelle brought it up again, because it does bear repeating. My advice for someone in Emoca SMC pursuing adoption is to, it's a point, but with a caveat. I would say do your research. As I think has become clear from this conversation, there are lots of different ways to pursue adoption, and they're not created equal. There's different prices, different time lengths, et cetera. And so there's a lot to weed through for you to decide if you're going to do it at all, but also which path you want to pursue. So definitely do your research. And how you do that research, there are books out there. There's this podcast. There's certainly a lot of Facebook support groups on adoptions and very large groups. But what I would say with the Facebook groups in particular is just be careful and consider your source, right? Mm-hmm. Know that some of those groups are going to be much more geared towards couples than singles. And some of them are going to be much not as sensitive to the particular challenges of a Emoca SMC. So I think the best thing you can do when you're doing research is to find other Emoca SMCs who have adopted and have a heart-to-heart conversation. Everyone that I know, and I know many, we are very passionate about helping others and happy to have this conversation. And I think that can often be your best resource.
Yes. I would add that adoption agencies also sometimes treat their Black clients differently. Sometimes it's a really positive experience, sometimes it's not. So understanding how to approach adoption agencies as a Black person is important.
Thank you both, Angela and Michelle, for allowing us to pick your brain and for just sharing your knowledge and experience in such a generous way.
Thank you for having us. Yes.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Join us next time as we continue to discuss this often hilarious journey of being a Black SMC. Well, Pod, thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you like what you heard, please share this podcast with your girlfriends. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about the topics covered in this episode. So email me at mochasmc@gmail.com. And if you found value in the topics covered, consider making a donation using the link in the show notes below. Till next time, Pod. Bye now.